Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, peace be upon you, and welcome to another episode and a live broadcast from the Forum for Islamic Dialogue. This is actually our first broadcast in English. We will be doing more of that. My name is Wissam Sharafuddin, and I'm one of the founders of the Forum for Islamic Dialogue. And today we will be talking about the Islamic Dialogue goals and challenges. I have the pleasure of having with me today in our virtual studio, Mr. Baqir Muhyiddin and Ms. Hadil Ismail. Hadil, she is a Lebanese-American who has a bachelor's in supply chain management from the University of Michigan. And she is currently an MBA student specializing in global supply chain and international management at Wayne State University. She grew up in Saudi Arabia, went to Islamic private schools, and moved to the United States. She's fluent in both Arabic and English. Baqir, he was born in Canada, and he is an Arab-American today who manages MPAC's Policy Leadership Institute. That is Muslim
Public Affairs Council.
Public Affairs Council, Muslim Public Affairs Council's Policy Leadership Institute, which consists of three anchor programs: the Young Leaders Policy and Government Summit, the Congressional Leadership Development Program, and the Graduate Policy Research Fellowship. Baqir holds a Master of Public Policy from Michigan State University, where he studied impacts of lobbying in Washington, D.C. Hailing from Dearborn, Michigan community, Baqir spent much of his free time volunteering at community organizations. Baqir has held executive board positions at various organizations, including a mental health organization where he has published studies regarding Arab and Muslim attitudes towards various topics. Baqir enjoys writing blogs about topics relevant to Muslims and Arab Americans and American foreign policy. Prior to his master's, Baqir completed a BBA in finance and an associate's of science. Welcome both of you to the studio.
Thank you, Rasmina.
Thanks a lot.
This is not how I know Hadil and Baqir. I know Baqir from a long time ago from basically Islamic work in Dearborn. He's been an active youth in the Dearborn community, working with a lot of youth organizations. And I know Baqir from then as a leader from the first time I met him as a young man in Dearborn. And I know Hadil as a poet. We met in the Dearborn open mic. She has, did you publish your poetry yet?
Yes, I published it last year, but I actually took the book off the market. So that's a little bit of the press now.
Which I understand as a poet, but
yeah,
Hadil is a poet. She's a published poet, and hopefully we'll see more of her poetry out there. Today, guys, we're discussing the Islamic Dialogue. It's really going to be more of a personal reflection. And also, as both of you activists in your communities, also a reflection from that experience. So I want to pose the first question. We'll start with Hadil. How do you see or define Islamic dialogue? What does Islamic dialogue mean to you? And why do you feel it's important? If you feel it's important, why do you feel that?
First and foremost, I'd like to say that in my opinion, any sort of dialogue, especially one that's related to faith or spirituality, is very subjective. From my personal opinion, I think Islamic dialogue refers to any kind of conversations about opinions, reflections, experiences, outlooks, perspective, anything, because faith in general is a subjective matter, right? So everybody has their own experience with it and their own interpretation of it, regardless of the hard line rules and the do's and don'ts of whatever faith it is that we're discussing. So I think that's very important for us to have, because we can kind of, in one sense, we can let other people know that are going through a certain obstacle or a certain experience or epiphany even, that, hey, someone else has been through this, someone else understands this, you're not alone in it. On the other hand, it's like if somebody has questions, if somebody's feeling displaced or out of place, They also have someone that they can refer to and talk to about these ideas and these emotions that they might be facing, which is why I think it's very important to have these kinds of discussions.
Thank you. Baqir, how do you see or define Islamic dialogue, and why do you feel it's important?
Okay, so Islamic dialogue, it's important to discuss ideas, especially, it's hard to define what Islamic dialogue is to begin with, because there's 1.7 billion Muslims around the world with many different point of views, and who represents Islam? Is it the Arabs? Is it the South Asians? Is it Americans? The culture of every country also has an effect on what, like, Islamic norms are, and is it based off the societal norms of the area they're in? Are they living in a developed nation or a developing nation? I don't like those terms too much. But dialogue is important because Islam right now, it's at a moment where it's intersecting between two different worlds, like between the East and the West. And especially for those of us that are living in the West, it's colliding with our Western identity and whatnot. What do we hold on to? What do we let go of? How do we adjust our especially as like first generation immigrants? How do we adjust our norms that our parents raised us with, but we don't really get along with our identity here living in the West? So from that aspect, I feel like Islamic dialogue is very important, like especially pertaining to us over here. As a whole, it might not be if it's working in the Middle East, or if it's working well enough in South Asia, maybe it's not as important for them to discuss it over there. Although this millennial generation right now is pretty united through technology. So there is already disconnected between the parents' generation and the youth generation, that a favorite song of a kid in Pakistan might be the favorite song of a kid living in the United States or in Europe. So maybe it is important to have that dialogue in that aspect as well. Furthermore, there is a big difference between having a conversation about Islamic dialogue between the lay people, like such as ourselves, or I don't know if that's offensive to say or not, and between academics. And by academics, I mean those that have studied the Islamic literature and the traditions and the Quran, and they know the Arabic language well enough to do to understand the tafsir of the Quran, or to understand those that have given their opinions about the tafsir of Quran as well. And I say there's difference there because, like any other topic, even scientists right now who are talking about COVID, if you look at scientific opinions regarding how the world should be dealing with this crisis and how the world is dealing with this crisis, there's a humongous disconnect, right? So what we can say here on live casting or on a podcast or at a barber shop or anywhere else at a coffee shop may not be accepted by the layman, number one, and number two, won't hold grounds anyways with the academics. And I feel like with Islamic dialogue, academics do keep a lot of their opinions within their circles. They don't want to disturb the norms of societies with what they believe in to begin with. I don't know if I got off of a tangent, but
that's my answer. That's good. I like this tangent to discuss it. So we've been, like, last Sunday, the Forum for Islamic Dialogue, we had two major scholars from Lebanon, have a discussion about dialogue. And next week, we're going to have scholars also discussing a topic live. But I feel that the notion that dialogue is, or that the excuse that is sometimes used, that you cannot talk about Islam, or you cannot talk about religion, or you cannot talk about even your culture if you are not an expert in it, kind of sometimes is abused. It has some valid points to it, but sometimes it's used to suppress dialogue. Why? Because at the end of the day, you are a person who has used your capabilities to accept a certain philosophy, to decipher traditions to customize your understanding of your religion to your life. You, to a certain degree, you are also a working mind, you know, in the way that religion manifests in your life, or the identity, not necessarily, because Islam sometimes it's not a religion, sometimes it's an identity. It's a cultural identity, sometimes with much less theology in it, and sometimes it is a complete theological entity. So the manifestation of it into your life, that's something that that you are responsible about, and you can represent, you can talk about. Dialogues take place most of the time between people. There isn't a person who hasn't gone through some sort of dialogue about their beliefs or the lack thereof. What do you think, Hadir?
So I'd like to say one thing. As far as what you said, people usually feel like we're not allowed to have an opinion, or we're not, our opinion is not valid enough unless we're an expert, right? Like, we should leave it up to the scholars or the sheikhs or the imams. But in a sense, we're all experts of our own experiences, because the sheikh and the scholar and the imam is not living my life, is not living your life, is not living Bakr's life, right? So no one can really understand our experiences and our emotions and our perspectives on faith or religion or whatever the case may be, except ourselves. So in that sense, we are our own experts. And I feel like in another sense too, the scholars and the academics are such a small percentage of our community, whereas the layman, as you call them, Bakr, is the majority.
Layperson, not layman, please.
Sorry, lay people. We're the majority, right? So we need somebody that's going to relate to us, and we need to be relatable to others as well. Because like I said, the academics are such a small majority. Now, there's a difference between having a dialogue and sharing opinions and sharing perspectives. There's a difference between doing that and bringing some sort of new outlook to other people or to ourselves even. There's a difference between doing that and between imposing opinions on other people. Now, the academics, the people that have studied and have knowledge of both languages and of the tafsir and the Quran and all of that, they are in a valid place to give us rulings almost, right? Like, hey, you do this, you don't do that. These are the following reasons based on the knowledge that I've acquired. There's a difference between doing that and between just sharing opinions and perspectives, right? Like, this is how I've lived my life so far. These are the experiences that I've had with Islam and with religion and with combining my identity as a Middle Eastern Muslim and a Western American, right? So we shouldn't shy away from these conversations whatsoever. If anything, they should be encouraged and more allowed, in my opinion.
So I agree with there in a sense. Like, nobody speaks on my behalf. What's the opinion of a Muslim to me is what I think. Wassam cannot speak on my behalf, neither can you, neither can the biggest turban in the Middle East or in North America, or my own brother, or any Shi'i, or any Sunni, or whoever. Is it working?
Yes, we hear you.
All right, but for me, it's frozen on my screen. Yeah, so I represent myself and I speak on myself. And when someone asks me what do Muslims think about this, I clarify, this is what I think. The general opinion might be this, other opinions might be that, but this is what I believe and this is what I think and this is how I deal with it. However, the reason why I bring up academics, I mean, academics don't have to be how is it trained? They don't have to be trained by a seminary or like an Islamic environment. It can be a non-Muslim academic that applies the academic principles and look for proof and for research and whatnot to give their opinion. Like if I give my opinion regarding something, right, and I stand someplace and I tell them, listen up world, I just reached the conclusion that A, B, and C because C, D, and E, and I share it on social media, right? Who's going to care? Maybe some of my friends might talk about it with me or not, but it doesn't really have weight to it. Mm-hmm. So what's the goal of the Islamic dialogue? If it's trying to do change, it's going to require more than the average person to discuss it. It's going to require people that are actually experts in the fields to discuss it and reach conclusions, because they do have the backings, they have the accreditations to make their opinions valid to back it up. It's similar to right now, if I was going to talk about supply chain, and I've worked at a gas station, and I come and I try to school Hadil about supply chain, she's going to tell me that's very cute, but you know, it's for you.
You might present some data that opens her eyes.
Sorry, go ahead.
I said you might present some data that opens her eyes to.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's not necessarily about change. It's just about perspective. Because if you think about it, faith goes into everything. And I'm going to keep going with the analogy that you just gave me. Supply chain goes into everything, right? And as a gas station worker, you might have picked up on a few things as far as shipping or distribution or whatever the case may be that I haven't noticed because I haven't worked in a gas station. I've just seen the overall picture that I've learned or that I was taught to focus on. So you can bring new perspective. Yeah, it might not change the way I think. It might not change the entire concept of the supply chain in its entirety, but it'll just give me some perspective, right? And that's the point of dialogue. That's the point of conversation, whether it's about religion or anything else. It's seeing that, hey, even though we're all united in this one thing that we call Islam, Islam can take on many different faces and many different identities in itself. And by sharing these conversations, you're learning about the different faces that it can take on. And maybe from those conversations, you can adapt your own perspective of it and change and tweak a little bit of what you perceive already. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, but I go back to saying, like, what's the goal, you know, for the dialogue? Like,
so let's talk about that. Let's talk about the goals of Islamic dialogue, because like Baqir said, at the end of the day, I might give you some perspective, but maybe I cannot give you a comprehensive theory or law in because I just don't have enough training for it. That's where the scholars, you know, play a role. For example, the dialogue between Sheikh Mahmoud Cheltoud and the Sheikh, famous Sheikh Azhar, and the Shia scholars in the 40s gave birth to in the 50s to his famous fatwa of allowing Muslims to follow the Ja'fari school of thought in jurisprudence as one of the schools of thought that can be followed other than the Hanafi, Shafi'i, Hanbali, and Maliki. So that was very, very effective dialogue because it was with people who had that authority. And nevertheless, we defended the also the importance of dialogue at all levels, even children having a dialogue in kindergarten. That's important, mm-hmm. And we should encourage it. And we made that point clear. So let's go to the goals, Baqir. What is the goals? What is the goals of Islamic dialogue? What do you think the goals should be of dialogue right now? Are we wasting our time? And what's the goal we want to get out of this dialogue?
Change. I think at the macro level, or like we'll say with the experts and with the academics, the goal should be change 100%. How to better our societies with the environment of today, with the scientific advancements, technological advancements of today, with the social advancements of today, adapt to our new society and whatnot. Those should be the goals at the macro level. At the micro level, where it's us talking, the goals there is basically to understand the world through somebody else's eyes, through their experiences, through their own perspectives and whatnot, so that we can better understand each other and build on our relationships. I don't see much change occurring through like societal changes occurring through on the grassroots, which doesn't sound right to say. Mm-hmm. But end of the day, I feel like there are the vast majority of the populations, they don't like to critically think. I do believe that. They are very comfortable living inside the house that's built for them, and they don't want to step outside those boundaries. And how dare you question those boundaries? Now, it can be regarding religion, it can be towards science, it can be towards how to deal with your wife and kids or with your husband. With your significant other, whoever it is, most people they're comfortable with it. Regarding Islamic dialogue, on the flip side, you can have the biggest like defender of the current Syrian regime flip overnight their support for the Syrian regime if a scholar was to say otherwise, right? So I feel like on the grassroots level. To make this change happen, it's much more effective when it comes from up top than from the bottom.
That's interesting. I'll give Hadil next to turn, but I just want to bring in a point that came to my mind, because it seems like a circular logic sometimes that we're caught in. We sometimes say that people, they do want to get the, you know, their guidance from the scholars or maraja or, you know, the higher authorities. And they don't want to really have an input. They don't want to have really, you know, to bother themselves with critical thinking or research and just leave it to the to who they believe is the expert that they trust to follow. At the same time, you'll go talk to those experts and they'll tell you that we are limited in what we can expose because people are opinionated and they have grown up with certain predispositions. And, you know, I've seen it all the time studying Hausa, where I'm taught something in the class and the teacher would say that this is something we don't discuss outside. People are not ready for this outside. And you know, there's numerous of stories where Maraja, they say that, you know, this, if people, you know, they're very careful of how they expose their opinions to people, as if people are so opinionated that they have to be very careful. And how, you know, I remember the story, this story at least is referenced, so I can mention it, where Sheikh Sayyid Tijani is Samawi, in his book, one of the books, I think it's in Thumma Hatadayt, he says that he was sitting with Sayyid Al-Khoui in the Najaf, and there was a group from Algeria that came and visited the mosque, and they were praying. And he said, I wish I can stand up and go pray with them and behind them. But, you know, people will you know, will have a negative reaction to that. And there are these kind of stories. There are numerous stories like this where people are afraid. The scholars are afraid of the people. So if the scholars are waiting for the people's approval sometimes, and they have to take into consideration, and they have legitimized this methodology by saying maslaha al-islamiyya, right? It is not beneficial right now to, for example, proclaim my opinion because it will have so much negative reaction, like the one that Sayyid Fadlallah had in 2005 that emptied his mosque for a historical opinion, not even a jurisprudence opinion or something that is in aqaid or, you know, theology. So the people say that, oh, we're waiting for the scholar's opinion. You know, what is the problem over here in this conundrum? Hadil, can you comment first before we go back to Bakhrian?
Yes. So as far as that issue is concerned, I think Bakhir brought a very good point that people like to live comfortably, right? And they like to stay in the houses that were built for them, exactly as he worded it. But the thing is, there's a certain thing that they're used to. So for example, if you have a Shi'i marja, right? They're going to look to that marja, that scholar, to tell them the basic do's and don'ts of their life. How many rak'ahs to pray, how to pray them, when to break their fast, when to start their fast. That's what they look to the scholars for. But if the scholars dare to change their opinion on anything that's more major than that, anything that requires actual thinking, and that goes beyond something that they had been comfortable with for years. For example, if a Shi'i marja were to accept a certain aspect of the Sunni sect, right? And say, you know what, we've always thought that this was wrong just because it was different. But now as a Shi'i marja, I'm standing and I'm saying that this is fully okay. People are going to take issue with that, not because they have their own opinions and those scholars are scared. It's just because when it comes to actually critically thinking, they don't want to do that. But when it comes to something that they're used to being changed, they also don't want to accept that. So it's like they don't want to start something on their own, but they also don't want to change what they've always known. Does that make sense in a certain way? And I've experienced that personally, just because I've come from both sides as well, right? Where it's like, hey, like you have to, for example, I've had someone tell me before that if I practiced my whole life as a devout Muslim, but I didn't follow a specific marja, then everything I've done doesn't count. Then everything I've done, every practice I've applied in my life, every salah that I have prayed, every day that I have fasted, it doesn't count because I haven't called myself a specific follower of a specific marja, right? But on that same note, if I wasn't going to do any of that stuff and was just going to say, you know what, yeah, you're right, I don't want anything to do with this religion of yours, I'm not Muslim, that's something they're uncomfortable with. That's something that they're not okay with, even though it's not coming from a scholar directly. So people don't want to change what they've always known, but they also don't want to have to make decisions for themselves on the minuscule things, I'd like to say.
Bakr.
All right, so I'll start by addressing what that person told you. I'm willing to bet all that I have in my checking account right now, which is including the stimulus check from the president, that the person that told you this is not one of the higher up scholars. It's probably just one of us, or maybe a mosque level sheikh that's doesn't really have too much weight in the scholarly world. Because my experience, scholars, even if they were to believe something and they were to deal with somebody in an issue regarding similar to this, they'd find reasons to make it halal and to tell you, oh yes, you can believe this through this proof and that hadith and this and whatnot. Regarding the scholars saying they're waiting for the people, excuse my language, but I call bullshit. The scholars aren't being honest with us. I believe the scholars are scared of each other. Sayyid Allah 2005 bomb that he dropped on the Muslim world, on the Shia world, would have been treated differently if other scholars treated him differently or agreed with him and whatnot. So when they say the world is not ready, no, they're scared of the opinions of the office of Sayyid Sistani or the office of Sayyid Shirazi or the office of Sayyid Talallah or Sayyid Khamenei. Either they're scared of what those scholars would say, and it may take away from their following's base, or the scholars may go as far as, I mean, we saw attacks on Sayyid Talallah. He became Fadl al-Shaytan by some and Dhal al-Mudhil by others. So it's not that there people are not ready for it, but they're scared of the way that academic dialogue happens with Islamic scholars is different from the West, in a sense where, first of all, they're similar through studies and through the way that they build their knowledge and they get their accreditation and whatnot. That's very, very similar. And the way that they find their proofs and the way that they do their research is all very, very similar. I was mesmerized when I took a crash course on Ilm al-Rijal by Ayatollah al-Khoi, how academic-based it is. That's the similarity with the Western worlds. The difference is, and I guess it's not that different, because even in the Western world, you have peer-reviewed journal entries and whatnot, where your peers will give your opinions, right? So it's similar in that sense. The difference is, in the Islamic world, we see personal attacks and assassination of characters. And if a scholar steps out of the comfort zone of the other scholars, right, they won't, like, no one will say this guy doesn't have a PhD in the Western world, right? Or this guy is not, his science is all wrong, you know, almost on a conspiracy video, which has been circling around lately regarding COVID. They won't go that far. They'll say, no, they're wrong, because based off of our proofs of A, B, C, D, they'll make a journal entry to disprove this person's journal entry. While in the Islamic, and I'm going to speak Shi'i specific, because that's what I am, and this is what I know, and it's what's connected to me. It just becomes ridiculous. They want to disprove this person. All his books that he's written over the past 40 years all go to waste, and this person, you cannot listen to him no more. You cannot hear him no more. Don't marry your children off to the person that follows this person. It gets very ugly. So I don't believe it's the population is not ready for what the scholars got to say. But I guess I see it more along that the scholars are afraid of other scholars and the pushback that might come with their findings.
You know, the important thing is this. This is what we need to get out of dialogue. First of all, before I continue, I want to bring in a point that Ali Al-Aridi has mentioned here, a comment. I can't show it because he left it on my page. Shouldn't Islamic dialogue be used to highlight the beauty within the religion? Change becomes a burden. With change, it should be internal and should maybe come from someone believing in the change. I think the intention and motive is to educate. Teachers give different perspectives, and it's up to what one believes to allow any understanding. I think It's a beautifully said by Ali al-Aridi, and I think it supplements or complements Baqir what you've mentioned, that the purpose of dialogue is change. I think it's a kind of a dangerous word, change, because the purpose of dialogue is change. What if change didn't happen? Is that means a failed dialogue?
You can use a more dangerous word for of evolution.
Yeah, through dialogue, evolution through dialogue, you mean?
Yeah, the evolution of norms through dialogue.
Yeah, I get what you mean
about the academic levels and them starting to change and all of that. But I disagree. I think it starts at our level and through conversations like the one that we're having now, because any one statement that you can make or that Baqir can make can bring some sort of new perspective to my mind. And me as a person and a person that God gave me the ability to critically think, I'm going to look into that. I'm going to do my own research. I'm going to do my own studying on whatever statement was made that caught my attention. And my perspective may be altered. And then I'll speak to my friends and my social circle and my family and maybe alter their perspective. And yeah, change doesn't happen overnight, but the more these conversations are allowed and encouraged, even not just conversations of like, hey, do you think this is halal or this is haram? Well, based on this marja, I think that, and based on what I know. No, I'm talking about conversations of the concept of faith and spirituality in itself, right? Where we no longer are shunning people or telling people. And like Baqir said, sometimes families will say like, hey, don't marry this person just because of the marja they follow or the daya they're from or whatever, because it's relevant to a certain sect that they follow. I think that's where change needs to be made, not in the religion itself or the academics or the perspectives. It's just how we are viewing things and how we are allowing people, whether they want to have different opinions or not, whether people want to be very religious and very practicing or people want to be very liberal. We can't just, this is the part that, in my opinion, that's the point of these sorts of discussions, to show the wide spectrum of thinking that we have when it comes to these matters. So by sharing these conversations from one to the other, one social circle to the other, one country to the other, through podcasts and live streams like we're doing right now, that's how change is born. And I think evolution is not a dangerous word. That's a perfect word to describe it, because it's not going to change with us directly. It'll be in our children and our children's children from conversations that we're having now, and it evolutionizes through time. So I don't think that's a dangerous way a word. I think if anything, that's a perfect way to put it. And that's something that we should aspire to.
Right. Evolution represents a natural change that happens slowly. And if anything, that is the most positive way of change, you know, something that's not abrupt or that, you know, because change sometimes can be painful in some perspectives. But I know that Baqir meant that a positive way of meaning of
change. Yeah, I have no problem with evolution, with the word evolution.
we're keeping our discussion away from biology right now. There's so much biology taking place outside in the world. Biology has taken over actually our world today, so we want to break from it. But one thing I wanted to aspire for is to have a society where, and this is the aspiration I think of the founders of the Forum for Islamic Dialogue, and it's nothing other than really the foundation of any thinking society that allows freedom of thinking, is that we want to have the freedom of thinking and the critical thinking to take things and analyze them and have a discussion about them and have a dialogue about them. And then the experts, the scholars, when they want to present something, they know that they're presenting it for people who are going to have dialogue about it, who are going to have discussions about it, and they'll be more careful and they'll be more calculating to the effects of what they're giving and what they're saying. The time where people had to follow blindly and not question, I remember decades ago when a person came and asked a kind of a controversial question to a scholar in one of the mosques. And the scholar looked at him and asked him, "Have you read this book?" And he started naming books for him. "Have you read this book? Have you read this book? Go read them and then come back and ask the question again." And at that time, I felt, wow, that was, you know, impressive. But now I look back at it and I felt that this was really something that is really a criminal act against the mind. He suppressed. Imagine every time you ask a question to someone, they're going to answer in such a way. It's going to give you a list of books that asking you to read them before he answers you. If there is any problem today, it is the public perception of science. It is the disconnect between the Islam that is in the books and the big scholars, like, you know, what Baqa told you, he guarantees that that scholar was not a major scholar that answered you. Because there is a disconnect between the scholarly Islam, even between science and between public. And we need to bridge that gap, I think, by dialogue. Moving on, and if you have any comments, you can address them in a second. But moving on to the next part, which is we want to talk about how do you assess the current situation of Islamic dialogue? I want you to assess it in a general way, and also then reflect personally on your experience with Islamic dialogue in our community or internationally or whatever. We'll start with who were left. Bakr, I think we were left with you.
All right, so the current situation of Islamic dialogue. I've been having dialogue my whole life. From as long as I started to think, I've been having dialogue. I remember as young as I was like 6 or 7 years old, and my father would force me to go to Islamic school, which was boring. And it was taught by people that shouldn't be teaching children to begin with. Not that the idea is good, but you know, the way that our parents carried out as first generation immigrants was not right. And I just learned how to read Arabic recently through WhatsApp, not through those years I spent at those schools. But I remember questioning my dad, telling him that I'm a Canadian Muslim. Why should I learn the Quran in Arabic? Why should I learn Al-Fatiha in Arabic? And I memorized Al-Fatiha in English and Surah Al-Ikhlas in English. And like I said, I'm a very proud Western child, and I'm going to learn it in English. So that was me having dialogue with my dad from a young age. You know, at that time, my dad told me, memorize it as you choose. You'll learn it eventually, whether you like it or not. So up until our teenage years and our 20s and even our 30s now, the endless discussions that we've had on every subject you can think of, from A to Z, at Shisha Cafes in Dearborn, nonstop, every single night. All it takes is two guys to be there, or two friends to be there, because it's not always just guys. And the topics will open up, and we'll start discussing, and we'll start pushing the limits, and discussing this and that, and adding in opinions of sociologists that are in the West, or feminist movements in the second wave and whatnot, and what does the scholars in the East say, and are there any scholars that say this that are not known in Iran or in Pakistan or whatnot. Something to as simple as Islam, the requirement of Islamic burials right now with COVID or not. One person brought up that there's a Shi'i scholar that's Qummi that doesn't even believe that it's required to be buried in earth. It can be cremated. That's without COVID or anything, right? So these discussions, I believe that living in the West, these discussions do happen, and they do happen frequently. And all over the place. My experience in Iraq, my family's in Najaf, which is the historic Shi'i hub of Shi'ism. And as a Najafi, I still consider it the current hub of Shi'ism. So that might not be true anymore. I had discussions with my uncles and with my aunts and with my cousins, whether they disagreed with me or not. And I was not the outlier there. I had cousins there that considered me to be conservative, right? I don't know if that's unique just to Najaf, because it's the city of the seminary, and it's like they're more open to discussions. I've heard different experiences in Iraq and other parts, in Baghdad and Baghdad and in south and whatnot. So I do not know what to consider. I know in Iraq there are red lines you don't cross, right? There are political red lines you don't cross, and if a religious opinion is associated with that political opinion, it's dangerous to cross that line. And then there's also societal norms. where if you're from the LGBTQ community and you speak out in Iraq, it might not be the safest right now, you know, from an Islamic perspective, you know. But societies evolve at their own paces, right? And what works at one place doesn't necessarily have to work at some other place, right? And everybody is evolving. What's the norm with my uncles and my aunts is not the norm with my cousins. It's far from it. And it's far from the next generation's norms. So it's not necessarily a bad thing that things are different. Western-style democracy is working over here, or some might say it stopped working now. You know, but other parts of the world, you need to have a dictator that's not a tyrant in order to have a peaceful society, and that's productive and enlightened. So, okay, I went off on a tangent again, but no,
So your assessment, yeah. if you want to, yeah, you know, recap and assess the current, yeah, situation of Islamic dialogue.
I think it's good. There are parts of the world where it's not good. I have not been to any place in the world that I cannot speak my mind, mm-hmm, but I know for a fact where if I'm in some places in the world, it, just having my name as Muhammad Baqir is dangerous, because that opens up the doors of, oh, he's a Shi'i or Rafidi or whatever. So that's my answer, the summary.
Hadid?
So I agree to a point with what he was saying. We are, especially here in the West, we are in a very much in a better place as far as dialogue is concerned, whether it's religious or otherwise. And I think the advantage of that is a lot of people are more exposed to education, are more exposed to different cultures and different religions as well, which makes them okay with discussing their own religion amongst themselves in their own circle. But like he said, even in the West, even in America, even in Dearborn is a prime example, which is a city that's a very Muslim, Middle Eastern concentrated city. There's always red lines, right? And there's always certain opinions and certain topics that are just taboo that you don't discuss. You don't, if you're from this political party and you're discussing with someone of the opposing political party, you don't have that conversation. And I am the biggest person, I stand against that so firmly, because again, I think that dialogue is so important in enlightening people and giving them fresh perspective. And sometimes there could be more similarities than differences in opposing opinions than you might think. And that's why I think it's, again, it's so important to have these conversations, because, and I can use my personal experience and my personal just conversations that I've had here being in Dearborn. I'm my dad's side of the family is as Sunni as can possibly be. My mother's side of the family is also as Shia as can possibly be. So very opposite sides of the spectrum. And both like to appear as, oh, we're open-minded, we're accepting, and they don't like to be judgy, and everybody tries to be educated and whatnot. But when it comes to a certain point, there are red lines. There are things that you don't say. There are things that you can't disagree with. There are things that you can't agree with. And here in Dearborn, it's mainly Shias that live here. I grew up in Saudi Arabia, which is an extreme Sunni country, right? And that's where the majority of my Islamic education came from. And if I were to have a conversation here with just someone from my age group, someone that's educated similar to what I've been educated, someone that works in a similar workforce or field that I work in, someone that's very equivalent to my level in life and my experience, right? If I were to have a conversation with them, and they're, for example, Shia, born and raised Dearborn, and I were to speak from a Sunni perspective or just try to highlight some things that may not add up in their own ideologies, that's a conversation that's automatically shunned. And I'm not even given the opportunity to discuss or present facts or ideas or theories or whatnot, just because, oh, you're from Saudi, or your dad's Sunni, you don't count, your opinion doesn't matter, we're on the right path. And the same can be said to the other side, don't get me wrong, because like I said, I'm very much in the middle. I don't think a label defines an identity of faith. I'm against that completely. But same can happen on the other side. When I was in Saudi and I would meet people and I would say, hey, let's talk about history. Let's talk about Ahlul Bayt. Nope, no, we don't do that. Let's talk about the Sahabi. Why though? And that's the problem with not allowing conversation and dialogue and not encouraging it. Because when someone is raised in a certain environment that's concentrated and emphasized in one certain perspective, they're never going to be exposed to anything different. They're not going to see anything in a different light. Unless somebody comes from the outside and sheds that light and has that conversation, that very uncomfortable conversation, and crosses that red line and brings up those taboo topics, nothing is going to change. everybody's going to be limited in their way of thinking. We can all talk about, yeah, we're unity, we're open-minded, we're here in the West, we're liberal, we can accept other religions and other cultures, but we don't accept differences within our own religion and our own culture. And I think that's a big, big issue that's happening here in the West. Whereas in the Middle East, they don't have that because there is no other culture. There's just them fighting each other constantly.
Thank you. This is a very important reflection and honest one. And I've experienced something similar to you. I think a lot of people who have diverse families like this or have lived in diverse places, they'll find it difficult to with people who are only like mono colors. And they will. And the problem is there's always this leap into questioning the other person's character. Mm-hmm. You know, whether they stop hearing what you're saying, and they start saying, "Oh, that's you've been influenced by this or that." Whatever perspective you bring, they'll leave the question as where it is because it's not familiar to them, mm-hmm. and they'll question your motive or they'll question your background, kind of to dismiss the source of the question. It's easier than answering the question. And then also growing with red lines. It's always about adding red lines or removing red lines, but there's always red lines. While the Quran, on the other hand, has no red lines in the discussions. Actually, the best promotion of the perspective of the shaitan is the Quran itself. It has immortalized and eternalized his message and his perspective, which actually gave birth to some groups that actually like the Satan's perspective. To that extent, you can blame the Quran for it because it has popularized, but this is how much the defense of dialogue and free speech in the Quran, that it lists the whole perspective of the story of the shaitan. So do you think...
Just one thing, just before I lose my train of thought. So you were talking about all the red lines, right? And how even in the Quran, there are no red lines. In Islam in itself, there are no red lines. It's something that has been man-made over years and years and years of history, right? But this is a reflection that I've come to this Ramadan specifically, because I've tried to delve into the Quran a little bit deeper. And the more I read and the more I repeated and the more verses that I've really, really looked in depth in, the one thing that has stood out to me, the main concept that has stood out to me this Ramadan, is the concept of mercy, right? From God to people, from God to prophets, from God to angels, mercy. It's just a redundant, repetitive concept that's repeated all throughout the Quran. And my thing is, if we are trying to emulate and live up to the standards that God has set for us as Muslims, right? Because this is what we aspire to be on the right path, to do what God has asked us to do, to be good people, to do good, be good, live well, and just have a positive impact on this world while we're in it. If this is our goal and we're trying to emulate this all-merciful God, who are we to block conversations and assassinate characters, as Baqir said, and negate someone's faith or negate someone's intellectual abilities just for having differing opinions, when God himself, the main emphasis of our entire faith, is merciful and is listening, and is he's the one who has given us the ability to think in the first place. Who are we as humans to come to a person and tell them, hey, you're wrong, you're dumb because you're different, or your opinion is invalid because it's opposing to mine? Who are we to do that when God himself is merciful to all? Why are we not showing that same mercy in our conversations and dialogue?
So can I just chime in a bit? Maybe it's because I'm in quarantine outside of Dearborn and I really miss my Dearborn life over here. It's the longest I've been away from Dearborn in a long time. So I'm Detroit and Dearborn are a big part of my identity, but I'm an outsider in Dearborn. But I was born in Canada. I was raised in Canada most of my life. I was introduced as an American Muslim, but I'm a Canadian Muslim here on a green card still, just in case Uncle Sam is watching us. I don't have no citizenship yet. And I will not be voting this upcoming November. I'm in Dearborn, they called me Canadian in high school. I'm always an outsider. With the Iraqis in Dearborn, most of them came on different immigration waves than my parents came, so they're separate than I am. Within the Iraqis, my family follows Fadlallah and everybody else follows Sistani. So when I go to the Iraqi mosques, they have a different Eid day than we do, and different i'taqada than we do. When I go to the Falallah friendly mosques, I'm amongst Lebanese, but I'm the Iraqi, right? When I go back to Canada, all of the Azbaqi is the American one of us, you know. So I'm always on the flip side. Everybody's right-handed, I'm left-handed. So I'm not really an insider of Dearborn. Saying that dialogue does happen in Dearborn. The problem in Dearborn, which might not be limited to Dearborn, is that I want to say the religious circle, and I'm gonna talk about the Lebanese right now. About you guys, as an Iraqi, and I love Lebanese. I love
Kabin. Very carefully, if I were you, I'm just joking.
Yeah, I don't tread carefully. It's not my way. But I
oops, we lost him.
Oh, there you go. That's the British Bell part of you. So the Lebanese tend to be a bit more, when it comes to religion, unaccepting of other views. In Iraqi circle, everything goes. Like we'll be sitting with the most religious, and I don't know how to define religious anymore. It's not, because it seems like it's just how you dress and the words you use these days. But you'll be sitting with the most religious people and with atheists and with gay Muslims, and the conversations carry on. Next week, we're together. Nobody leaves. Same circle shows up. Amongst the Lebanese, if you're in one circle, you don't enter another circle. That's a big red line. When your super religious friend tells you that, be careful from listening to this person, then the people that are influenced by that religious person will listen to them. They will not come and speak to you anymore. So I've been there are people that I know by face that I've heard, don't hang out with Bakr, don't talk with Bakr. And I consider myself practicing Shia Muslim. You know, I'm not on, you know, there's nothing that's extreme about me, right? Or like what they would consider extreme or very fringe, you know? So it's not, it might not be a Dearborn thing. It just might be the personal circles. I guess it also does exist within the Iraqi circles as well, but it's just a different culture. And I do feel those differences. And I'm an outsider. So my personal best friend circle, I have a few of them. I have one with Iraqis, I have one with Lebanese, and I have some with Muslims, some with non-Muslims as well. So that's just my own personal reflection. I feel like Dearborn has a lot of dialogue going on.
Let me just say that maybe you don't find that dismissiveness in your Iraqi circle because you are an Iraqi Shi'i. As someone that isn't, I mean, I'm called Sunni even though I don't think I am. As someone that's not Iraqi and not Shi'i, when I'm associated with Iraqi Shi'i circles, and this is not to say everybody, some of my closest friends are Iraqi Shi'is and I love them to death, and we've been friends for years, and I have a very diverse social circle just because of my education and the different fields that I've been in. But having said that, I agree with you 100% as far as Lebanese are concerned, especially in Dearborn. There's a very toxic mentality of excluding people and very tight-knit circles that don't allow anyone in or out. But that's also very occurrent with Iraqis as well. It's very occurrent with the Yemenis as well. It's very occurrent with Palestinians as well. I think it just summons down to the concept of being Muslim and being on one side of Islam. People tend to be very, very, very hesitant to let anybody from an opposing Muslim side into that circle or share an opinion or a perspective. And I've said that I've only been in Dearborn for, I would say, 10 years. I'm an outsider to Dearborn as well. I moved here as a teenager. And till this day, I have not found my niche. I have not found my place, so to speak, because I don't fit in with these circles and with these people that shun out critical thinking and just being intellectual and delving into different ideas. But as someone that has been exposed to many different circles, whether it's political or Islamic or whatnot, that dismissiveness comes from all sides and all aspects.
Thank you, Hadir. So we have 5 minutes left. First of all, I want to tell our audience that we are very rare do people do this, and we actually put a link to join our live conversation. This is how open we are about voicing your opinion and including you in the debate. So you actually go to that link, you can actually enter video and sound. You can only, if you want, pick only sound. You can enter into our conversation. Also, if you leave comments on the feed, we will show these comments. We have a compliment for you from on my personal feed. It's not on the Facebook feed, Hadil. Second of all, I want to leave now the rest of the questions, and I want to focus on something really that you know I feel deeply about right now. So it seems from everything that we've said, we're actually kind of traumatized by personal experiences, and that gives that intensity in what we're saying. Every one of us have reflected on some kind of a negative experience that's almost a trauma experience of shunning or calling names within a close niche. You know, you described it as the toxicity, you know, that toxic environment, and that can be in any place. You know, we don't want to really project that into the city that we're living in. This can be in any environment, really. There's reasons for that. I want to talk in the few minutes left to make this really practical, okay? If someone says, oh, no, you know, you can, someone right now says, no, everything is fine. You can have this dialogue anywhere you want. Everyone is open. Someone denies the claims. We want to zoom in and basically mention or say, what is it that we can do that we're not doing right now, and that we can do to remove that toxicity from our community, to remove that wherever we are, wherever this community is. What can we do to make it more friendly and more open to diversity and to dialogue? We'll start with Baqir, and we'll end with Hadir.
All right, so you're right that this toxicity exists everywhere. So my wife is a Muslim convert who converted before I met her, and she converted to Sunni Islam, and I like that she's Sunni. So we're not in Akhir together because we're spending our life together. That's my spiel. But she's raised in a very, very strict, even evangelical, practicing in church and whatnot. She started college like 6 years ago or 7 years ago in Grand Rapids, and that was the first time in her life she found out that Catholics are Christians, because she was taught that Catholics are a different religion and they're going to go straight to hell. They're the first people, them and the Mormons. So she didn't even know that Catholics consider themselves Christians until she met Catholics in college. And she's a white American, raised in America, raised in Metro Detroit. Even at the church, they used to teach them how that woman should get married and go to school, get educated. But in Sunday school, they used to teach her how to iron clothes, because that's what a woman does when she gets married. And that's in the advanced American world, that whatever. So regarding, just remind me one more time of the question, Wissam, kind of.
Okay, what do we need? What do we need to, you know?
Oh, to make change.
Yes, I mean, you are a victim of the intolerance in some cases of diversity. What can we do to remove that intolerance? How can we make our environment and community more open to dialogue and diversity?
So I'm a very extroverted person. I impose myself on people. They don't like it, they can walk out. And I try to find people that have similar minds to me and stay with them. And I try to make the change through action. So if somebody wronged me, I don't necessarily become rude to them. I just stay the exact same person that I was to them before they did so, and hope that, you know, they pick up on my actions or not. And if not, who cares? There is 7.5 billion people in this world. So that's how I deal with it. I impose myself. I try to associate myself with like-minded individuals, or at least like habit or moral people, or I don't know what the correct word is, it that have the same habits as me, where they don't like showing up people and whatnot. That might not be as easy for introverted people, or maybe for females in an Arab world or whatnot, but I don't have an answer, but this is how I deal with it personally.
So you've mentioned your defensive mechanism, really. Hadil, yeah. Do you have some advice on how can we improve our society in a way that will remove that toxicity and be more open to dialogue?
So if I may, I'm going to share Imam Ali alayhi salam, a quote from Imam Ali where he says, "Wama naqashtu jahilan illa waghallabani," and the translation is, "Never have I debated or argued someone that is ignorant, and I have always lost." So I think the one thing that we can all do, regardless of what side of the spectrum we fall on or where we think our ideologies belong, the one thing that we can all do is educate ourselves. never let ourselves be in a point where we're considered the ignorant one or the less knowledgeable one in a conversation. If you come across something that you don't understand or that makes you uncomfortable, learn about it, research it, study it, read, ask questions, have conversations about with people with that opposing opinion or a different opinion. And the more educated we all become, the more tolerating we are towards each other and towards just any concept as a whole in society. So I think education is just the, and I don't mean education by go to school and get a degree. I mean, a lot of people do that and are still very ignorant, unfortunately. I mean, educate yourself as far as history, ideologies, concepts, people, theories, just educate yourself.
Can I just add on to what Hadija just said? Because it got me kind of thinking about what she's saying. I don't even think it's education. I think it's ethics, morals, the way that you're raised. People that have akhlaq, that are well raised, they're more accepting. Sometimes you find the most what we would consider the most simple person and very, you know, one-sided person living their life a single way are the most accepting of the most different people, and it's just because they have the right morals or the right ethics, right? So maybe it's not even education. Maybe it's just raise your kids correctly. Raise the future generation correctly. So
we'll end with this comment and question from Dr. Abbas Yusuf says, what would Muslims learn on accepting others living in a secular society? So I want to remind you that we are speaking here and we have been raised for quite a while in Western society, the ones that have the First Amendment, has defense for liberties and freedom of expression. One of the most countries that has defense for freedom of expression is the country that we're living on, due to the great vision of its founding fathers. So we've learned a lot from this society. Do you want to mention some of the things that we've learned from this? Hadil, go ahead.
The one thing that I've learned the most from being an American and living in this society is that, and even though nowadays this climate has changed a little bit and people have become more sensitive, but the one thing that I've learned is it's okay to be different regardless of what different means to you. It's okay to not conform regardless of what conforming means to you. Different isn't necessarily bad. It just means different. That's all it is.
Baqir.
Diversity is strength, whether it's diversity in opinion or diversity in ethnicities or cultures. But the more diverse that you have, it's like a toolbox. If you only have a screwdriver, you can only open up the flathead screwdrivers from whatever that screwdriver is. But if you have a hammer, you have a saw, and you have this and you have that. If you diversify society with different thoughts and ideas, you're going to bring different perspectives to problems and you'll find a better solution.
Thank you very much. I want to add one thing here to our dialogue to even add the practicality of it, is that we as individuals and members of society, if we find any nonprofit organization or a community organization or some individuals that claim our representation or our leadership, and they create any kind of a situation where it's difficult for a dialogue, they create a division or they sow hatred or they make dialogue more difficult or make it a taboo or they scare people from dialogue and from diversity, we need to address that. We need to not allow that to take place. I was once in a, I love this moment, I was once praying in the mosque on Dix, and there was a guest visitor, like a sheikh visitor, who was touring, and he looked like he's a visitor from Saudi Arabia who was touring the world and giving lectures. So he was giving a lecture in the mosque, and during his lecture, he started speaking against Shia. And once he started speaking about Shia, the elders in the mosque who are sitting started shouting and yelling at him that we don't talk about this here, you know, why are you talking about this? And they kept yelling at him until they stopped him from speaking. And that was a moment that I loved so much. I wish that every time And I'm not calling for rebellion and, you know, an uncivilized way of addressing matters. But what I'm saying is, and I'm not describing what they've done as uncivilized either, but what I'm saying is that when we see something wrong, to address it, to not to let it go, not to leave and say, you know what, that was something I heard that wasn't very positive. Well, what did you do about it? We need to address it. We need to, you know, I wrote once an article and I was a little bit harsh. And Sayyid Tijani in Dar al-Hikmah, in Islamic House of Wisdom, asked me, why were you harsh? I felt like you're a little bit harsh in that. Why were you harsh? I told him, because I want the scholars who give their opinion to know that there is people who are listening who are not going to accept. Just like you are afraid of people feedback who are so much extreme, you also have to be afraid of people who are moderate, that this is not going to be acceptable for moderate people. I feel that many of our scholars and organizations, they try to not to get extreme people mad. They try to compromise for the extreme people, but they know that the moderate people are patient and civilized, so they don't worry about them. Well, the moderate people also need to voice their opinions, the silent majority, I think. So I just wanted to pass this, and we are out of time, so I have nothing to left except to thank you very much for showing up for this dialogue, Hadil, on a short notice. And Baqir, I'll leave you with the final words, and thank you very much. And our listeners also thank you. And we hope to see you in upcoming episodes, Forum for Islamic Dialogue. And if you'd like to be with us, or you like to suggest or propose any kind of a topic, please let us know. Hadil, final word.
I just want to thank you, because it's people like you starting platforms like this is how change starts to happen slowly but surely. So I want to thank you, and I want to thank you for knowing that there are people that are going to be willing to have these conversations and participate. And thank you for thinking of me for it, for sure. So
thank you, Hadil. Baqir.
Thanks a lot for hosting us and for holding these conversations, and more power to you to keep holding these kind of talks for people to hear these kind of the people that don't speak about it. At least they can hear it in their own comfort of their homes without having to step outside their comfort zone to hear these conversations. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you, everyone, and happy Ramadan again, and assalamu alaikum and good night.